I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe David Carl. He's director of the Graduate Institute at St. John's College, and he's co-founder of the St. John's Summer Film Institute, which is just starting up. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you're branching out beyond great books into film?
That's right.
How does that work? What does that look like?
Well, if you have a good sense already of what we try and do with books at the college, which is it's a classic liberal arts college devoted to the reading of great works of literature, philosophy, history, and our entire education at both the graduate and the undergraduate level is based on the reading and the discussion of those works of literature and philosophy. We started asking ourselves a few years ago whether we could have similar conversations about movies, that is, treat movies as texts, and what would a careful and thoughtful reading of a movie look like in the kind of environment that we've tried to foster for the reading and conversation of books. So I guess I'd say the question is, what does it mean to read a movie as opposed to simply watch a movie? What's the difference between those two experiences?
So what is the difference?
I think it's the difference between the notion of entertainment, which I have no criticism of, but I think of as largely a passive activity, something that happens to you, and a more active kind of engagement where you're actually doing something, interacting, as opposed to being acted on.
And so what does that active part look like? I mean, I remember when I was in college, I would go see movies and just be overwhelmed by them if they were really great and didn't analyze them, and it sometimes takes a second viewing to even begin to analyze them, and it's still that way today, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. There are different experiences watching a movie, as there should be, just as there are different experiences of reading a book. I don't think that all reading is the same when you bring it to a book, and all viewing isn't the same, depending on what sort of a movie you're spending your time and energy on. There are times when I come home from a 12-hour day at work and I just want to put a movie in and turn off my brain for 2 hours. There are other times when I'm really actively engaged and want to challenge myself and challenge the film by thinking about what is it I'm seeing here and slowing things down. The better I've gotten at doing this, the longer it takes me to watch some of these movies. It's gotten to the point where it could take me 5 or 6 hours to watch a 90-minute movie now.
Do you watch it once through without stopping first?
If it's a movie I'm not always already familiar with, absolutely. That's the pure experience. That's how the movie was designed to be seen, and I think it's the right way to have an initial encounter. But in the same way that, take a novel or a poem, for example, you read the work, and if the work has touched you in a significant way, you want to understand more deeply, how did it do that? Why did it do that? What is it I responded to? Not to explain the phenomena away, but to further deepen that experience. You can read a poem line by line and really analyze each aspect, the meter, the rhyme, the imagery, the sound, how the poem comes together as a whole. You can do similar work on a film. It's not the only way to watch a film, but in the last few years that I've begun studying film more actively, it's become a very rewarding form of engagement with film as a medium.
Now, there are books and there are great books, according to St. John's, and it must be the same for film. How do you choose what gets into the canon, so to speak?
That's an excellent question, and one that we have vexed ourselves over to no end. What I've realized, it's over a year now that we've been working on planning this summer institute, and the institute will be an 8-week summer program.
Just like the Graduate Institute.
Like the Graduate Institute. And each week we'll focus on the work of a different director. And we arrived at that decision after many, many conversations between a group of faculty who formed a committee to think about this, including study groups with students, with other colleagues, a number of film courses which were taught at the college as sort of a trial run for this full summer program. And for the longest time, my intention had been to come up with a kind of canon of great cinema in very much the way that you just used the word. That's what we do at St. John's for our undergraduates. If you come to the college, every single freshman reads Homer, their first night in seminar. And from Homer, you go on to Herodotus and Plato and Thucydides and Aristotle and the Greek tragedies. In the sophomore year, you read the Bible, you read Roman history, and eventually you get up to the early decades of the 20th century by your senior year. I thought I could reproduce that historic arc with cinema. Superficially, that should be easy to do. Cinema has only been around as a commercial and artistic art form since, say, roughly the early 1900s, just a little over 100 years, whereas literature, going back to Homer, is thousands of years old. But I simply couldn't do it, not even with the help of a number of very well-informed colleagues. The more we tried to come up with the canon of great movies, the more we found ourselves disagreeing with each other, arguing, well, this has to be in, no, this can't be in. The decision to go to the 1 week for each director grew out of the phenomena that we came up with a list of about 100 directors that we thought were truly great directors over the history of cinema, say the last 100-120 years. And we thought, we can't fit the greatest works by all 100 of these directors into a single summer. It's simply impossible. So why don't we pick 8 for this summer? Next summer we'll pick a different 8, and each summer we'll renew the program. So in a sense, it's a disavowal of the notion of a canon, which is so close to the heart of St. John's. Everything we do in the graduate and undergraduate program at St. John's depends on there being a canon of great philosophers, of great novels, and I think we feel pretty confident about the authors that we have put on that list, especially before the 20th century. The closer you get to our present world, the more vexed and problematic the notion of a canon becomes, and we don't make any claims or pretenses to having a grasp of, say, 20th century canon.
Why is that? Just because we're so close to it?
We're close to it. We haven't had time to see how it ages, how we continue to respond to it over multiple generations. A work that we're constantly discussing or arguing about, what makes any work of art great, a painting, a piece of music, a film, a novel, a poem. But it strikes me that one of the things that a great work of art has to have is a kind of timelessness, that it continues to speak to people far beyond the time and place in which it was written. So we just don't know. You're profoundly moved by a novel that was written 10 or 15 years ago. If that novel doesn't move or speak to people 100 years from now, it will no longer be read.
No, it's interesting, but there's always art that is art of its time, that is incredibly important and has huge social consequences in its time, but doesn't stand the test of time. And that, you know, how you talk about greatness, that's one definition of greatness, is standing the test of time. But I mean, I think of, I mean, apologies to anybody who might disagree with this, but, you know, Allen Ginsberg. Mm-hmm. That seems already quite dated when you read Howl.
Sartre as well in France. Yeah. It was huge in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and I think is... very few people read existentialism today the way they did 50 years ago.
But it was those things were incredibly important in their time.
Absolutely.
And history wouldn't be what it is without them.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're looking for those works which touch us and continue to touch that broadest notion of us, you know, beyond race or gender or location. If I read a Chinese novel written 3,000 years ago and it speaks to me as urgently as it did to someone from China 20 years ago or 2,000 years ago, then we found something that is more than its local circumstances taken together. And film, I think, can be that too. It may be one of the reasons we had such a hard time coming up with the quote-unquote canon of film, is it's so alive to us, but it's also so close to us.
Yeah, it's all 20th century or a few 21st century films. Now, we're talking to David Carl about the St. John's Summer Film Institute, which is just about to launch, so people can get involved with this and take the very first summer of classes this coming summer. Is it something that you think would be useful for filmmakers?
Yes and no. I have spoken with a lot of professionals in the film industry. I went to college in Southern California. A number of my colleagues have gone on to work in Hollywood. And of course, in New Mexico, we have a thriving film industry here as well. And that's a question that's come up a fair amount. This will be very strictly not intended for people who want to get into the making of films, whether that's as screenplay writers or actors or technical support. We're really interested in helping people see films better, to see more, to become more sensitive to the work of art in front of them. On the other hand, I've been teaching college students for well over 20 years now. When a student comes to me and tells me they want to write and what can they do to be a better writer, I invariably tell them the only thing I'm confident will help you in your writing is to read great works of literature. So in that sense, I think watching great films and becoming sensitive to the things that have made films, whether from the 1920s or the 1960s or last year, what makes those films great, will help sensitize someone whose ambition is to be a filmmaker or to participate in the making of films. But we're not going to be taking a professional stance where here's a workshop on lighting, here's a workshop on editing, here's a workshop on sound, etc.
No, but I mean, you sent me something that you'd written, which was in a kind of detailed analysis of several minutes in the film The Godfather, and there's this hospital scene, which I've seen that movie I don't know how many times, and I'd never noticed all the details that you brought out. And I think one of the things that kind of very close analysis, just the way we do at St. John's, I mean, I went there many years ago, but with books, when you look at it really closely, when you look at that hospital scene, for example, very closely, you see that there are so many ways in which the greater themes of the movie are shown to you visually or through audio, but in a way that's not kind of obvious and hit you over the head with the symbolism. Hey, you didn't get it, dummy. Here's the, it's subtle enough that it must go in unconsciously, and that's why we think it's a great movie, or subconsciously. But here we are. You've written this thing. Now we see them, and it's stunning.
That's how I have come to think of it myself, that watching movies at its best, and as I said before, there are lots of reasons to watch movies, and I watch movies for lots of different reasons and lots of different moods with lots of different people, but one of the most valuable things that watching a film can be for me is it's an education in seeing. You start by learning how to notice the thing on the screen in front of you. At its best, who knows what implications that might have for our ability to see when we leave the movie behind, that it may be a kind of sensitizing to the whole world around us that the movie is an explicit opportunity to engage in. So there is a real opportunity for a sort of self-education, a sensitizing to detail, to nuance, to color, to people's facial features, to body language. I think it's rarely debated anymore the incredible influence that movies and by extension television have on human beings in the world today. It breaks down international and cultural barriers. It almost doesn't make sense to me to talk about international cinema anymore. When you think about the early movies of a Japanese director like Ozu, who had been tremendously influenced by the American filmmaker Ford and the Ford's Westerns, then you think about how Kurosawa was influenced by American filmmaking but went on to influence Steven Spielberg or went on to influence Sergio Leone in Italy. Because films are filmmakers are being influenced by people from all different countries, their own films are embedded with that sense of multiculturalism. So yes, it's Japanese cinema, but it's Japanese cinema that's been influenced by American cinema. And yes, it's American cinema, but it's American cinema that was influenced by Russian cinema.
Right, exactly.
So it's all pervasive at this point. All cinema is international in that sense.
And I think that something that you're doing, which is interesting and important, is there's a lot of people who are doing, for example, media analysis, and they're teaching you how to see the ways that commercial media are manipulating your mind. And there are cultural studies programs where they can take basically anything at all as a text, a comic book, a sitcom from the 1950s, mm-hmm. and that is the text. But using those tools on something which, you know, a lot of smart people have decided is really great art brings it up another notch to where you're really engaging something which is inherently worthwhile.
Yeah, I began teaching in the California Community College system in the late 1980s, or was it the early 90s? And there was a book that had come out called Killing Us Softly, which was an analysis of the portrayal of the female body in American advertising. I mean, at this point in culture, I think we've sensitized our awareness to those sorts of things. But in the 70s and 80s, it was a sort of revolution for people to start noticing works like John Berger's Ways of Seeing, the critical work that came out of France in the 1960s around, say, movements like Situationism or Semiology, and then the work of Roland Barthes was really getting us to see how advertisement starts to affect the way we see the world around us. It's an incredibly powerful tool, whether that's for good or bad, depends not on the medium, but on our response to the medium.
And each new generation of adolescent girls has to learn this stuff all over again because they're still being bombarded with it as hard as ever.
Sure. I mean, when I was in college, the big scandal was about whether the nose of the Camel cigarette was supposed to look like a penis or not. I don't know if you remember the... I still to this day don't know whether that was true or not,
yeah.
But that's what everyone was talking about. Like, we're being brainwashed by the images around us.
Right.
But it's not a question of being brainwashed. It's a question of recognizing how powerful visual images are and getting on top of that power so that we are aware of what's happening rather than having it happen to us. Maybe it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the difference being being passive and being active in our engagement with the work.
Well, and cigarette ads... only purpose is to get you to buy cigarettes, whereas a movie like The Godfather or a movie like any of the ones that you're going to be talking about this summer, the films of John Ford and of Ingmar Bergman and so on and so on, they're not created to manipulate people. They're works of art.
Even works of art can have a manipulative effect if...
But they're not trying to get you to buy... I mean, there are ideological films that are propaganda films, but... the films you choose presumably are created with kind of more range and subtlety and expansiveness than a simple agenda of trying to get you to purchase a product.
But it's interesting how that those two bodies of work inform each other. What the movies have learned from advertising, what advertising has learned from the movies. I think becoming more sensitive to the movies we watch, by extension, necessarily makes us more sensitive to all the other ways in which media bombard us.
The St. John's Summer Film Institute gets underway this summer.
Do
you have people signed up already?
We do. Because we're launching it as a new program, we're going to have a relatively small starting class, and we want that class to consist of a number of different types of students. Some of them will be students who are currently enrolled at the college and are on their summer break. We're also interested in reaching out to members of the Santa Fe community who may not have been involved with St. John's before. And I imagine we'll have alumni who want to come back and do it.
Anyone can apply.
We had an initial application deadline in December, but we've had so many applications that we've decided to possibly open up a second section and extend that. So we'll now be accepting applications probably up through the end of April. And the application is available on the college website, as is information about the program, including a complete list both of all the films we'll be watching, but also the books we'll be reading in support of those films. We've come up with a list of books primarily written by the directors we'll be studying. A book on film by Renoir, Tarkovsky's book, Sculpting in Time, Robert Bresson's book, Notes of a Cinematographer. So we'll be watching movies by directors and reading the works that they've written at from a more theoretical or practical perspective about how they came to make their movies. So we're not drifting too far from our original passion for reading. We're just combining reading and movies.
David Carl is director of the Graduate Institute at St. John's and co-founder of the St. John's Summer Film Institute. If people want more information, they can just call St. John's at...
the Graduate Institute office, which is... 505-984-6083.
Or you can just Google St. John's and find it there, St. John's Santa Fe. David Carl, thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.